Just going to go into normal. What? Back to this and
anything.
No, there's no rules.
No rules. Around here,
you see, there's no rules. But come on, just give me the signal. Give me the signal. Yes. So he said, I didn't agree. Okay. Good evening. We've all heard of three alarm fires. I think we're at risk of becoming a three alarm seminar. So I have, but fear not, I have an understanding with the good people from the Stanford Fire Department. They will not be making another visit until at least after this session, so you can give me your full attention. I think the title of this talk that was given, unbeknownst to me, was something on the order of the oral tradition after 3,300 years. I personally don't really favor referring to what we're going to talk about as the oral tradition, as will become a little clearer further on. But if I had my druthers, I probably would have titled the talk From Bible Belt to Borscht Belt. And the reason is because up until this point in the seminar, we've heard some very compelling material about the divinity of the written Torah, which really, up to this point, makes us into good Baptists. Because they too accept the divinity of the Torah, as do the adherents of many of the other world's great religions. And our goal now should really be to make the journey north from Bible Belt to Borscht Belt, or maybe all those hotels are now defunct, so maybe it's now called Bungalow Belt or whatever it is, but we want to now become Jews, because the unwritten Torah, as I'll refer to what was called the oral tradition, the unwritten Torah is really what makes us Jews. The unwritten Torah that was the first part of the Torah that was given to us, as we'll talk about, surprisingly. It's the unwritten Torah about which God says that I've established my covenant with the Jewish people over the unwritten Torah as opposed to the written Torah. It is the essence, it is the heart and soul of the love relationship through the generations between God and his people Israel. The unwritten Torah is the one that's ours, only ours, that other nations, other religions haven't gotten their hands on. And we see the product of the part of Torah which they did get their hands on, what they did to it. And finally, it's the unwritten Torah that accounts for probably about 97% of what observant Jews do all day long, every day. It's the unwritten Torah that makes us Jews. So we begin our journey from Southern Baptist Bible Belt to authentically Jewish Borscht Belt, or Bungalow Belt. Of course, some people would say also that not only does the unwritten Torah make us Jews, but it makes us into a particularly unsavory sort of Jew, which is a fundamentalist Jew. Of course, there's nothing more nonsensical in the world, as we'll talk about. As we begin to understand what the unwritten Torah is, it begins to dawn upon us that if fundamentalism means some kind of hyper-literal clinging to every word, following every word of the written Torah to the letter, then we are the absolute antithesis of fundamentalists. In fact, we're probably the only Jews and the only religious people who are non-fundamentalists. So this evening we're going to focus on three important questions in this area of the unwritten Torah. First of which is, how do we know that there is something called an unwritten Torah? After all, it's unwritten. Secondly, assuming that there is an unwritten Torah, why couldn't all be written? Why did there have to exist something, a portion of the Torah, the major portion of the Torah, as we've described? Why do there need to be these two components, a written and unwritten component, and largely unwritten? And thirdly, if indeed there is an unwritten Torah, how do we know that it's been transmitted down through the generations accurately? But before we even begin to address any of those questions, we probably should define our terms. So let's talk about what an unwritten Torah isn't, and what an unwritten Torah is. Here's what it isn't. I don't know about you, but when I hear the term the oral tradition of the rabbis, the sages, I don't know what comes to my mind, and this is probably as a result of much too much TV and movie watching in childhood, but I conjure a Hollywood scene in which there's an elderly sage, slightly suspect, frankly, who's sitting alone by candlelight. All of a sudden he calls out to his devoted disciple in the outer room, Simon, hey, come into my chambers. Yes, Rabbi. He hurries into the chambers and said, Simon, close the door. Yes, Rabbi. Simon, are you ready? I'm going to share with you the secret for vegetarian Christian. No, I mean, the secrets of the oral tradition. Yes, your master, can you share the recipe for real kishka too? And maybe throw in a couple of hot stock tips? That's what we think of. It's the oral tradition of the rabbis, handed down by one sage to the other. One sage in each generation to the next, in secret, so that no one else is in on us. That's what the oral tradition, the unwritten Torah, as I call it, is not. What is it? What it is a multi-generational, nationwide project of exploring and clarifying God's will for the Jewish people, and by extension for all of humanity, and by extension for all of creation. It is the most monumental project of sheer intellectual brilliance, of burning spiritual passion, and of unspeakable dedication that humanity has ever seen. It's a project, a nationwide project, that has involved, that has engaged tens of millions of Jews, our ancestors, and us today. Many of them dedicating their entire lives to this project, every waking moment. In an unbroken chain, generation after generation, a documented unbroken chain, generation after generation, involving hundreds of thousands of Jews in every single one of those generations down to this very day. In fact, let me introduce you to one of the newest members of this nationwide project called the Unwritten Torah. He's a young man, an 11-year-old, lives out in Ohio, got an awesome three-point shot. His name was Mordechai. Also happens to be my grandson. And just last week, thank you, but hold off the mouth of those. Just last week, over Shavuos, his dad introduced him to the study of Gemara, study of the Talmud. He's now a member in good standing, a junior member of the unwritten Torah, of this project of the Jewish people. I say he's one of the newest members because probably since last week, there probably are dozens, scores, perhaps hundreds of even newer members around the world who have introduced the study of the Talmud, of the oral law, of the unwritten Torah for the first time. I'm a member of that project. And you, many if not all of you, are probably also members of that project if you've ever stepped into a Beit Midrash, a Jewish study hall, or if you've held a book of Torah, most likely a book of the unwritten Torah, in your hands, and you studied with someone, or you've gone to a class. We're all members. It's a living, thriving project in our midst. As we speak, there are hundreds of people around the world, in different time zones and different locales, lawyers and engineers, and storekeepers and zookeepers who are busy at work on that project of exploring and clarifying God's will for our world. Interestingly, this hotel is run under Jewish auspices. There's an entire room, probably got about 1,000 books at my count, largely comprised of the oral Torah, of the unwritten Torah. In fact, when we came on Friday, I just reflexively looked in the drawers to find the Gideon Bible. It wasn't there. Because in a hotel like this one, it's really worthless, the Gideon Bible. Ain't no unwritten Torah, not even one commentary on that. It's of no use to us. We've got a room dedicated for the 1,000 books of the unwritten Torah. Now, of course, now it's somewhat written, but we'll get to that too. So, really, going back to the first of our three questions, how do I know there's an unwritten Torah? It really is a rather strange question. It's like what took place once many years ago. There was a Talmud Torah class in Prospect Heights, just a stone's throw from the great observant Jewish communities of Brooklyn, Williamsburg, and Borough Park, and Flatbush. And it was a teacher and giving a class to the Talmud Torah kids. And one of the kids said, Mora, what are tzitzit? And the teacher explained that those are tassels that the Bible says that Jews should wear on the fringes of their four-cornered garments. That's tzitzit. Nobody does that anymore. And this is just, as I say, a couple of miles from tens of thousands of Jews who were doing that very day. So how do we know there's an unwritten Torah? It's coming out of our ears everywhere we turn. Hundreds of times a day I do things based on, not just studying, but I act as a Jew in fulfillment of the unwritten Torah, as does my wife and as do my children. So perhaps a better way to frame the question would be not how do I know there is an unwritten Torah, but when did it start? We've seen compelling evidence for the divine origins of the written Torah. How can we know that the unwritten Torah, too, traces its source back to Sinai? So, just a month ago in April, the Supreme Court came down with a ruling, I trained as a lawyer, haven't practiced in many years, so figured just I may as well somehow justify keeping up my law license and that constitutional law medal I got back in school. So we'll just share a ruling in the Maya case in April, in which the Supreme Court a majority ruled. They struck down the deportation of an illegal immigrant under the Immigration and Nationality Act. And the court, what was the law at issue was was one that called for automatic deportation of an alien who is convicted of an aggravated felony. And it's not defined, and it refers you to another section of the statute, which says that an aggravated felony is a crime of violence. And that, in turn, refers you on to 8 U.S.C. Section 16, which says, well, a crime of violence, that's a crime which, by its nature, poses a substantial risk that it's going to involve force in its commission. And the courts very logically said that this is unconstitutional because it runs afoul of a very settled constitutional doctrine called void for vagueness. This is far too, by its nature, it poses a significant risk of the use of force and so on. And the court said, the void for vagueness doctrine says that if a statute, if a law is too vague, then number one, you're not putting a potential transgressor of the law on notice. He has no way of knowing what it is he's allowed or not allowed to do. And secondly, it's giving far too much leeway and license to judges to creatively insert their own interpretations of that law because it's so vague. So now let's think about this. Here we come to the Torah, the written Torah, that is, the one that we understand now comes from God at Sinai. And we have a law that wasn't whipped up by some wet behind the ears legislative aide to some corrupt congressman, but by God Almighty. It's not a law that concerns deportation back to Guatemala, but something that concerns God's will for the purpose of the universe. And it's not about deportation, but it's about rather serious things like capital punishment, 39 lashes, kares, souls being disconnected, cut off eternally from God. So we open up the Torah, and we find that we're not dealing with laws that the Supreme Court would strike down as being void for vagueness. We're dealing with laws, terms, words, that we have no idea in tarnation what they mean, nor is there any way to know what they mean. So, for example, Kalaosa Malacha Yom HaShabbos Mos Yumos. Torah prescribes capital punishment for violating the Shabbos, for doing Malacha. Malacha, I can't translate it because it has no translation as such. For doing Malacha on the day of Shabbos. This was not an academic question. The written Torah itself tells us that there was an incidence of this in the desert, shortly after Sinai. A man was found chopping wood on the Shabbos. He was put to death. Talk about void for vagueness. Talk about injustice. Divine injustice. It's a cruel joke. Torah tells us, prescribes a whole series of laws that are predicated on the existence of marriage and divorce. Ki yikach ish isha. If a man shall take a woman. Shall take a woman. Wonderful, wonderful. Okay. If he shall take her what? Out to the movies? Then they're married? If he shall romantically take her across the threshold, as once upon a time they used to do? Or maybe this is a source for any young man. Take my wife, please. I don't know. We don't know. We have no way of knowing. And yet people are put to death for adultery and for illicit relationships. Let's go further. Talking about them phylacteries. And they shall be for a sign on your arms. A sign on your arms. Okay. Maybe this is the source for the Jewish obsession with demonstrating for social justice. You know, carry on them signs. Signs on your arms. It's not even a Jewish word. It appears nowhere else. There's no way of knowing what it means. But totofos bene nefa. So, of course, our Christian friends come along and help us out, and very helpfully translate, they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. Oh, that's wonderful. That really gets me places. Frontlets between your eyes. Well, let's see. What's a front? Well, a front is like when you're at the candy store and the mafia is running like a gambling operation out of the back. So maybe a frontlet is like a very small candy store with a smaller gambling operation. I don't know. This is how we bind ourselves to God every day. It's a problem. Let's proceed further. You can be cut off from God if you don't remove the Orla. The problem is that in the written Torah itself, Orla has multiple meanings. Moses refers to himself, Hein ani aral sposayim, I am aral of the lips. Voraltim Orla says Piriel, referring to trees. Umaltim is Orla Slavavchem in Deuteronomy. You shall circumcise the Orla of your hearts. It means so many different things. No idea. I think the Talmud might even have a passing thought that I think it tries to discern where, logically speaking, the Torah might be commanding us to perform circumcision. I think one of the possibilities it floats is something on the nose. I'm not sure, but that would perhaps be a source for Jews around with nose jobs. I don't know. But the bottom line is that it's a problem just in translating words. Vocalizing those words is a problem for itself. So we've got one verse which says, you shall not boil a kid, it's a baby goat, please don't let's not rush any judgments. You shall not boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. But ches lamed vav could just as easily be pronounced b'chalevimo, in its mother's fat. On the other hand, we have another verse elsewhere in the written Torah. It says, all blood and all fat you shall eat. But maybe that means all blood and all milk. Down neck of Nasacholah, right? We say that the source of milk is blood. Maybe it's not logical. So how do I know which is which? Maybe it's just the opposite of what Jews have done throughout the centuries. We have no way of knowing, because we have no way of knowing how to pronounce the words. Then there's punctuation. I'm getting a headache. Then there's punctuation. And by the way, punctuation is no laughing matter. Now, punctuation, if you punctuate things improperly, it can be very costly. You know, there was a fellow who was driving down the highway, and all of a sudden he makes this abrupt left turn, starts going the other direction, and he hears the sirens, he sees the red light flashing in the back. Officer pulls him over. Young man, can you please explain why you made a U-turn? Look at the sign right there, no U-turn. Fellow says, oh, you read it that way, I read it this way. No, U-turn. Then the officer says, okay, fine, and how do you explain, you know, I've been following you for about half a mile. How do you explain having thrown that coffee cup out of the window about a quarter of a mile ago? Didn't you see the sign? I certainly did. It said, fine for littering. It's costly. It's not just costly, by the way. It could be a matter of life and death. Because I remember reading about an elderly Russian-Jewish couple living in Moscow. And one night, after midnight, there's a knock at the door. You know, Mr. Rabinowitz trudges to open the door in his pajamas and bathrobe. There's a burly KGB agent standing there. You will come with me. What's the problem? Says, you're being arrested on charges of suspicion of espionage. We have the documentation right here. Says, what is it, please? Says, we have telegrams between you and your wife. We understand, is it not true, that last month you traveled to Leningrad and you sent the telegram to your wife. It says to operate, operate. And then there was a reply telegram from your wife to you. It says to operate, operate. No, this is nonsense. This is obviously coded language. You're obviously engaged in espionage. Mr. KGB officer, let me explain to you. I went to Leningrad to consult with a cardiologist. I would have needed a heart operation. So when I left the office, I sent a telegram to my wife. Says to operate, operate. My wife sent me back. Says to operate, operate. Punctuation is no laughing matter. And yet, even to this day, the Talmud tells us in Tractate Yuma that there are still five verses in the Torah that we just have no idea of how to punctuate. You know why? Because the unwritten Torah didn't tell us how to. That's why. We are up the creek without a paddle, without the unwritten Torah. Indeed, to take it just one step further, we don't even know an aleph from a beis. And for this, we have the Talmud itself to thank, in the famous story in Tractate Shabbos, in which the prospective gay or prospective convert comes to Hillel and says, you know, I don't buy any of this oral Torah, bunk. Just teach me the written Torah. And Hillel says, fine, no problem. Have a seat. Let's begin with the Aleph Beis. This is an Aleph, and that's a Beis. And now you go home. You know, you give him a Dalet. Now you go home and review. And we'll come back tomorrow for lesson number two. Comes back tomorrow. Okay, let's review. And the Talmud says, that's an Aleph. That's not wrong. Right there, you're wrong. Sorry. That's a Beis. That's an Aleph. He switches it on us. Yes, he told me. You told me this was not, that's a bit, what's going on? So, you're right. So, now you have a different perspective on that oral Torah bunk. You can't even know what's an aleph and what's a beis without an oral Torah, without an unwritten Torah. How do you expect to get through life? And speaking about getting through life, it's not just about knowing what's an aleph and what's a beis, or knowing how to pronounce words, or knowing how to punctuate sentences, or knowing the meanings of words. It's much more than that. It's about having a working legal and spiritual system for real human beings in the real world. You know, I just recently wrote an article, a profile of a fellow, very accomplished man, a great Torah scholar as well, in Israel, by the name of Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg. He put out a 6 or 7 volume encyclopedia of Jewish medical ethics, talking about all the conflicts. There are hundreds of them. Medical ethical conflicts. Hospitals are dealing with them every day of the week. And the halakha, Jewish law, the unwritten Torah, has a great deal to say about them. The Talmud has a great deal to say about them. And the succeeding generations of Torah scholars. If all you got is the Gideon Bible, you're really in trouble. How do you deal with ethical dilemmas? With conflicts between laws that the written Torah itself raises? You can't run a society based on the Gideon Bible. It's more than that. How do you have a judicial system? Let me read to you from Deuteronomy. If a matter from the written Torah... Does anyone have a watch? Because I'm at this point, I'm godlike, above time. Okay. Deuteronomy says, if a matter of judgment is hidden from you, between blood and blood, between verdict and verdict, between plague and plague, matters of dispute in your city, you shall rise up and ascend to the place that the Lord your God shall choose. You shall come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge who will be in those days. You shall inquire, and they will tell you the word of judgment. You shall do according to the word that they tell you, from the place that God will choose, and you shall be careful to do according to everything they will teach you. It's setting up a full-fledged, fully formed judicial system. If a matter of judgment is hidden from you, what could possibly be hidden from you between the lines of the Gideon Bible? There's nothing hidden. It's all out there. There's nothing that requires adjudication. There's nothing that requires examination and deliberation by judges. There's got to be something else going on here. And the truth is, besides the ethical dilemmas and the conflicts of laws, and besides the judicial system, simply to be able to fulfill the basic letter of the law of the written Torah is simply impossible in the absence of hundreds of details that are necessary to know how to adjudicate monetary disputes and how to adjudicate cases of crime, of monetary crime and of physical crime, how to celebrate the Jewish holidays, what our mitzvah objects, ritual objects look like, what they even look like. We have no idea. And then, of course, putting the Torah aside, let's just talk about ourselves, our own lives, society as a whole, a totally secular society. There is a professor at Yale Law. A nephew of mine went to Yale Law, and fascinating young man in his own right, amazing stories. Died in the accident at age 15 and left a quadriplegic, and still is, but he went on to almost finish a PhD in math, but decided he wasn't, he was too much of a people person, so he went to Yale Law, graduated, and holds a job in the legal stratosphere in New York, and also got married and has 2 children, Baruch Hashem. But in any event, so he told me his favorite professor was this Achil Amar Reed. Reed Amar, who's a professor at Yale Law, and he wrote a book a couple of years back called America's Unwritten Constitution. And he explained in there
that the written constitution, quote, cannot work as intended without something outside of it, America's unwritten constitution, to fill its gaps and stabilize its meaning and help make sense of the text. And Stanley Fish, who was a fellow who used to write for the Times, who was a leading literary critic and an academic of very great standing on his own, a dean of humanities for some 4 or 5 decades, passed away a while back, he writing about this book, he noted that in truth, quote, we have unwritten constitutions in every area of our discursive life, whether it's in law, higher education, politics, shop talk, domestic interactions, utterances and writings are meaningful only against the background of a set of assumptions that they do not contain. Textualism is not only a non-starter in constitutional interpretation, it's a non-starter everywhere. And really, when each one of us thinks about our own lives, I would ask you, anything you've done in life that's of significance, you know, is it based on solely on book learning? I don't know about you, but I don't want to be in the operating room where the doctor's standing there next to me. The aortic valve should be right over. I'm out of there. No, everything. It's everything. Our personal relationships, our professional pursuits, they're all based on traditions that we of learning from human being to human being. And finally, I'll just mention that, in fact, there is evidence seated in the unwritten Torah itself, where we have a number of Mishnayos, a number of statements in the unwritten Torah, whose context is specifically set in the Sinai period, in the Sinai era. Just one example, a Mishnah which is discussing the negayim, the question of a negav, of a leprosy, the kind of leprosy which would bring ritual impurity, as the written Torah discusses. And it talks about the case of someone who developed one of these instances of leprosy before the giving of the Torah, and now he's left with it after the giving of the Torah. And the question is, well, since he developed it before Sinai, so perhaps it doesn't bring upon him the ritual impurity that the written Torah designates for such an incidence, or perhaps it does. And there are a number of such things. That's a Mishnah that is utterly irrelevant at any point beyond a few months after Sinai. But it was right there in the unwritten law, the unwritten Torah, right from the get-go. And this, by the way, the fact that the written Torah is utterly useless without an unwritten Torah helps explain why it is that over the centuries, over the long centuries of Jewish history, without fail, our enemies have basically disregarded the written Torah and trained their fire on our people as the repository of the unwritten Torah. Talk about whether it's the Sadducees and the Bythusians, down to the early Christians, down to the Samaritans and the Karaim, and even beyond. It's always the unwritten Torah that gets their goat, that gets under their skin, and that they disparage and attack and claim is a fabrication. Why? Because they're more than happy to leave us with our written Torah, particularly in the way that they've had their way with it, what they've done to distort it. But even beyond that, it's useless to us. We're rendered completely unarmed as a spiritual people. Our relationship with God is severed if all we're left with is a written Torah, because it's the unwritten Torah that makes us Jews. Interestingly, if you walk into a Messianic synagogue these days, it's the funniest thing, because they too, as adherents of Jesus, so of course they reject the oral tradition of the Pharisees. By the way, that's another. You know, you read the historians, not only the Gentile ones, but unfortunately the ignorant Jewish ones who followed in their wake, and they talk about the Pharisees. That's us, the Purusha. They talk about it as if it was a sect. No, it wasn't some contained sect. That was the body of the Jewish people. They build up utterly, completely marginal cults comprised of a few hundred eccentric individuals like the Essenes, the Essene, and that they make it, oh, they're one of the three cults, so the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Essenes. The Essenes would be like, the Shalom Jewish Motorcycle Club of New Jersey. You know, that's a denomination in Judaism, you know. Nonsense. The Pharisees was the Jewish people. who in their hundreds of thousands and millions followed the sages, followed the rabbis of the teachers of the unwritten Torah. But in any event, so you walk into a Messianic synagogue, and you'll see that about 93% of whatever they're doing is all based on the unwritten Torah. They're wearing tzitzit, and the only way they know what tzitzit looks like, and what a sefer Torah looks like, and fill in, and the prayers, it's all rabbinic. Some of it is purely rabbinic, some of it is based on rabbinic understandings of the written Torah, because there are different parts to the unwritten Torah. A lot of what they're doing is purely rabbinic. Why? Why? Are they fundamental? What's going on? The answer is, because they have a religion to run. And you can't run a religion based on the written Torah. So, per force, they're forced to somehow live with the contradiction of rejecting intellectually the unwritten Torah, but actually living it in practice. Because they wouldn't have a business to run and a tax exemption to file without it. Okay, that's number one. How do we know there's an unwritten Torah? I think hopefully we've established that. How do we know that the unwritten Torah derives from Sinai? Hopefully we've established that as well. So let's talk about, but why the need for an unwritten Torah? After all, my father always told me, get it in writing. And by the way, carved in stone if possible, just like Moses. So why do we need an unwritten Torah? So, first of all, it's important to set some parameters, to debunk some, to define some terms again. The unwritten Torah. The written Torah, the unwritten Torah. Well, let's put it this way. The unwritten Torah was never, even at the very outset of things, back at Sinai, when it was first given, contemporaneously with the written Torah, the unwritten Torah was never completely unwritten, nor to this day, when even this hotel has 1,000 volumes of the unwritten Torah, and you go into some shuls and yeshivot, and you'll find tens of thousands of volumes. I myself have a couple of thousand. And even to this day, with all those volumes, and with literally tens, perhaps dozens, of books of commentary of, that are a part of that nationwide unwritten Torah project, are being published every month in the Jewish world today. Even with all that publication and writing, still to this day, it still remains an unwritten Torah. So it never was completely written, was never completely unwritten, rather, nor to this day is it completely written, even with all the publication going. Why is that? That's because, number one, you were always allowed to keep private writings. You were always allowed to take personal notes of teachings, of lectures, of interactions between teacher and student. It just could not be a part of the public institutionalized transmission of the Torah. But a person was allowed to keep personal notes with which to refer back to. After all this was reviewed incessantly and committed to memory. Just a stupendous intellectual feat on the part, again, as I say, of millions of people over scores of generations. There was a need for personal notes. And to this day, it remains an unwritten Torah. And anyone who's ever wrestled with a page of Gemara knows exactly what I'm talking about. My son-in-law and I, we just had it out with the unwritten Torah about 45 minutes this afternoon. It's like the story they tell in the local paper that had a little notice about the concert the evening before. The small town symphony orchestra played Beethoven last night. Beethoven won. So the unwritten Torah won today. Rabbi Simcha Wasserman, a great Torah sage, once referred to the Talmud as a brain grinding tool. Our brains are duly ground, I think, today. So it still remains. In other words, even when Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, in the second century of the Common Era, committed the Mishnah to writing, which, by the way, no, he didn't create the Mishnah, he didn't even edit the Mishnah, he committed it to writing, and it had been formalized in a very specific wording many hundreds of years before that, at the end of the First Temple, way, way before Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Even when he did that, and even when 300 years later, the Talmud itself was sealed, the commentary on the Mishnah, in all of these efforts, they invested tremendous effort to see to it that you still can't make heads or tails of it. Even with the Mishnah in writing, even with the Talmud in writing, and even now that we've got the Talmud translated into every language under the sun, and we've got commentaries and glosses and novelae up to the gazoo on all this stuff, Still, you walk out after an encounter with the Talmud or with any other aspect of the unwritten Torah, and you say, "Man, that's unwritten. That is unwritten. That is not. That's not there. That's not on a silver platter, which is just for me to just read and, you know, kick back with a beer in my hand and just, you know, peruse." No, not quite. Okay, so just having defined those terms, exactly what's written, what's unwritten. Let's talk about this question of why. Why was it so important? Why did God see fit to transmit what we say is really the lion's share of the Torah in this unwritten form? There are many, many very good reasons for that. Number one, it ensures that the Torah will remain, ensures the integrity of the transmission of the Torah. Because if you must have a teacher to student transmission, that means that the teacher will ensure that the student does not make willing, knowing distortions of the text for his own agenda, for his own purposes, nor will he have inadvertent misunderstandings of it. The teacher will make sure that the student understands it correctly, and that the student is not up to nefarious purposes with it. It ensures the integrity of it when you've got to study with a teacher. Secondly, having unwritten Torah ensures, as in fact history bears out, that it remains ours alone. As I said before, just look at what other nations, other religions have done to the written Torah. Just look. I'm not even talking about the sequels, which you always know the original is always better than the sequel, but the creative editing that has taken place. I mean, I'm reminded of this New Yorker story many very, very long time ago, about this Jewish literature professor, Sandor Needleman, and how he had this box, this supernatural box that he was just able to enter, and he would make two taps, and he could retro-transport himself back into literary history, so that, you know, he had a particular thing for, all of a sudden, he wanted to get into one of Flaubert's novels, And as the comic writes, he says, and all of a sudden, literature students in colleges across the country are wondering, what is a bald Jew doing on page 57 of Madame Bovary? So, you know, but this is what has happened with the Bible. I mean, what do you think it says in the Quran? Who is it that Abraham bound and nearly slaughtered on the altar? If you said Isaac, you're wrong. It starts with an M. Muhammad. I think. If I'm not mistaken. To brush up on my Quran. But all these sorts of weird things happening. People showing up who don't belong there. The entire religion based on a profoundly ignorant or profoundly distorted understanding of a verse in Isaiah. But this is what happens when you've got a written Torah that anybody can do whatever they want with because it's in a book. And all you need to do is buy it at the local... At Mecca's Barnes and Noble, and you're off and running. Thirdly, because the unwritten Torah requires a personal teacher-to-student transmission, the teacher will not even begin to teach that student until he can verify the bona fides, the integrity, the personal integrity, the character, the honesty of that student, whether he's a worthwhile recipient, whether he's a worthwhile link in this golden chain of transmission of the Torah through the generations. He's not even going to begin to teach a student who's not impeccably ethical and capable and intellectually capable. Which leads us to the next point, extremely important point, which is the Torah needs to be unwritten because Torah is not biology and Torah is not French literature. The Torah is there to transform us, to make us into a higher form of human being, or perhaps just human beings, period. The Torah is there to refine our character traits, to help us shed ourselves of self-destructive and destructive, period, ego drives and bodily drives. It's there to turn us into real human beings, godlike human beings. If I could just share with you briefly, just again from the aforementioned Stanley Fish. He's responding to a book that was written by Anthony Kronman, who was the dean of Yale Law School. And there's a lot of Yale in tonight's talk. I did not attend Yale. But in any event, Cronin had written a book in which he was singing the praises of the humanities, you know, the study of the humanities in universities, and how this can be the salvation of society. Sounds like he's back in 18th century France, but okay. But Stanley Fish, I'll read you what he says, but really his message is, Tony Cronin, get real. Here's what Stanley Fish has to say. The premise of secular humanism is that the examples of action and thought portrayed in the enduring works of literature, philosophy, and history can create in readers a desire to emulate them. It's a pretty idea, but there's no evidence to support it, and a lot of evidence against it. If it were true, the most generous, patient, good-hearted, and honest people on earth would be the members of literature and philosophy departments, who spend every waking hour with great books and great thoughts. And as someone who's been there for 45 years, I can tell you, it just isn't so. Teachers and students of literature and philosophy don't learn how to be good and wise. They learn how to analyze literary effects and to distinguish between different accounts of the foundations of knowledge. But Torah is there for us to learn how to be good and wise. And if that's not what you're in it for, then the rabbis say, get out of the business. You don't belong there. It's not just that it won't have the effect on you. It will boomerang. You will become toxic. A Torah scholar who has defective character traits, say the rabbis, a carcass is better than him. A Torah scholar who's in it for the wrong reasons, for ulterior motives, for his own self-aggrandizement, better off he wouldn't have been born. For as the Vilna Gaon says, the Torah is compared in many places to water, to rain. And rain is a very potent life-giving force. But it's life-giving to whatever it descends upon. And if it descends upon a jumble of wild weeds, wild and poisonous weeds, and that's what's going to grow and grow and grow as a result of the rain. And if it falls upon a beautiful garden of the one most lushly blossoming flowers, then that's what will grow. And that's what will bring life and beauty to the world. That's what Torah is there for. And if it was all in books, none of that would be accomplished. A student would not be able to sit and have the experience day in, day out, seeing his teacher, seeing the kind of ethically refined being that his teacher became as a result of the Torah. And the teacher himself wouldn't be able to convey the internal message of the Torah. He wouldn't be able to show the student that there's more than just the letter of the law. There's what God's trying to say to us. There's God's message. The heart and soul of Torah would be lost if it was all in books. It's got to be unwritten. There's got to be that interaction between teacher and student. Perhaps even more important than this is the fact, is the idea that the fact of the unwritten nature of the unwritten Torah is what tips us off to the idea that Torah is more than everything we've been talking about. Torah is the beating heart. It's the life and soul of a Jew's life and of our national life. It's something that we're constantly involved in. The study of Torah is the only one of the mitzvot in the Torah which is supposed to fill every waking moment of a Jew's life. Except if there are more important things to do, like building a family or pursuing a livelihood. When you say more important things, things that are of necessity, things that are exigencies that must be attended to, let's put it that way. Or perhaps a mitzvah that no one else is attending to. All of those things require leaving the Torah. But otherwise, the person returns to it and again picks it up. And again, at this very moment, in 1,000 shuls and schools and across the world, there are people who are studying that Torah on the Long Island Railroad and by Skype and by phone in every which way. The beating heart of the Jewish people. And almost everything they're studying is the unwritten Torah. It's the unwritten Torah that has enabled us to survive millennia of persecution and of exile. It has been our portable homeland, which we carry and which envelops us wherever we go. When 5 years ago, 90,000 Jews gathered at MetLife Stadium in the Meadowlands to celebrate the completion of the Torah, which Torah was it they were celebrating the completion of? The Talmud, the unwritten Torah. And just as a little note, as with an asterisk, I came across a JTA, Jewish Telegraphic Agency, interview with Rabbi Daniel Friedlander, Senior Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism. He was interviewed about why was it there was no Reform publicity of the event. And these were his words. Text study is very important to us, but we focus on the Or text, on Torah in particular. That's it. Talmud, oral law, is not our core text. It's part of how Reform Judaism looks at rabbinic law. We see ourselves as successors reclaiming the core Torah text. Oral law we do not find to be binding. So I don't know, when I was growing up, there was a very popular show called What's My Line? And you have a couple of people, and you have to figure out who was the real insurance agent, or who was the real nurse. And then at the end, you said, will the real nurse please stand up? Well, let me reframe the question. Will the real fundamentalists please stand up? Let's go on. Before we leave this second point of why the Torah needs to be unwritten, I just want to share with you one more very, very important thought in this area, which is a beautiful, beautiful understanding that Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, in his monumental commentary to the Torah in Exodus 21, presents. And it's based on a rather surprising historical fact. It's right there in the written Torah. Which is that if you walk up to the Jew on the average Jew in the street, you say, someone who accepts the unwritten Torah, right? You say, but which one was given first? Well, of course, the written Torah. No, no, no. That means you haven't been studying your written Torah well enough. Because what happens is, on the 6th of Sivan in the year 2448, is that God descends, the presence of God appears, nationwide revelation of the Jewish people, at which he pronounces the ten utterances, the Ten Commandments, after which, on the morrow of which, Moses ascends the mountain, spending 40 days receiving the entirety of the Torah, meaning the unwritten Torah. 5 hours? I don't think people can abide that. Can we humble? Good. So Moses goes up and learns the entirety of the Torah, which, as we say, is by and large 95-97% of is the unwritten Torah. When is the first time that the written Torah makes its appearance in the Jewish people? Anyone want to venture a guess? A week later? 3 months later? If you said 40 years later, you'd be right. It's not until 40 years, at the end of the 40-year, the four-decade sojourn in the desert, that Moses writes the written Torah for the first time. Which came first, the unwritten Torah? 40 years earlier than the written Torah. So imagine, understand what's going on here. You know what you had for those 40 years in the desert? Here's what you had. Frankly, for me, this would have been Gan Eden. This would have been absolute paradise. Any yeshiva guy. You had 40 years in which you didn't have to worry about a job. Well, didn't care. Didn't have to worry about food, most unbelievable catering, the best kosher supervision. You didn't have to worry about your clothes. You didn't have to worry about sending them out for the laundry, because they were all laundered. I just saw a statement in the unwritten Torah today. One rabbi says to another, okay, you know, they had these, the clothing remained eternally freshly laundered. Come on, after a while there's a certain body scent, you know, that starts to cling to you. He says, no, because there was this brook, this wellspring that traveled with them, from which they had their drinks, and there would be fragrant herbs growing out of them, which were turned into basically, you know, colognes and all sorts of sweet-smelling things that took away that. Everything was taken care of. No worries about enemies, no worries about wild animals, about anything. They were not open to the elements. They were completely enveloped, day and night. They had a divine GPS guiding them wherever they needed to be going. What, pray tell, did they do for 40 years in that desert? And without a sacred Torah, without a Torah scroll? The answer is, it was a 40-year national yeshiva. It was a 40-year Jewish study hall, the likes of which we've never again seen in the world. Of millions of Jews, the greatest minds and hearts and souls of the Jewish people, spending nothing but their every waking moment studying the Torah. Which Torah? The unwritten Torah. It's at the end of 40 years that they get the written Torah, which Rabbi Hirsch now comes along and says, is nothing more than, if you've ever been to a college class and you wanted to borrow the fellow or the girl next to you's notes because you missed a day or two of class, And you take one look at the notes and you say, I can't make heads or tails of this. There's a squiggle here, and there's an asterisk there, and there's a smiley face there, and a couple of numbers, and a couple of words here. I have no idea what's going on. Of course you have no idea. No one would have any idea except the taker of the notes. The written Torah are the notes on the 40-year lecture that they received. And the Talmud spells out exactly how the lecture took place. They learned everything four times, the entire nation. There's a whole description of it in the Talmud. It's the class notes on the lecture. The lecture, the stuff of the lecture was the unwritten Torah. The written Torah is nothing but the unwritten notes. So you have Moses going up the mountain, receives the unwritten Torah, and then 40 years later he receives the notes, the written Torah. So perhaps we can call them cliff notes. Okay. Let's just move on to item number three. Mr. Rosenthal is nowhere to be seen. Let's just skedaddle on to item number three. So we talk about, let's finally talk about the last question, very important question. Okay, so we know there's an unwritten Torah. We're in the midst of it, for crying out loud. We know that it harks back to Sinai. We know why it was so very, very important that there be an unwritten Torah. But bottom line, can I trust it? Can I trust it? We're talking Jews, after all, you know. After all, it's true. Yes, it's true. Maimonides does detail, document a generation after generation, 40-link chain of the greatest minds of the most exquisitely ethical sages in the Jewish people who received one after another in the 40 generations, only 40, between Sinai and the sealing of the Talmud in the 5th century of the Common Era. It's true he details it, but we're going to believe him? Come on. You know, the same people that for some reason have a problem, have some kind of problem believing that their own ancestors, same people that have some sort of compulsion to suspect them of being pious frauds about the written Torah, I guess why should the unwritten Torah be any different? So therefore we're going to have to do our work, because we're just not going to be able to take that documented chain of 40 generations at face value, because after all, it was Jews that are presenting it. So how do we know? Why should we believe? And the way it's often framed, by the way, the way this question is often framed is with reference to the game of telephone. Some people say Chinese whispers, but I want to be politically direct, we'll call it telephone. And so people frame the question this way. If in a simple game of telephone, we're whispering a message through a group of people, do we all know what telephone is? Right? It's one of these parlor games, you get together, friends on a night, and you sit around and you're supposed to transmit a word or a phrase from one to the other, and by the end of the chain, you see how the word looks nothing or sounds nothing like the word that you began with, and a good time was had by most. Okay, so if in a simple game of telephone, we're whispering a message through a group of people, one by one, eventually distorts the initial message, despite its being relatively short, and by only a few people, the transmission of the voluminous oral Torah through so many people over so many years certainly distorted its accuracy. It's a fortiori argument. That's part of the unwritten Torah too. We call it a kal vachomer. But in any event, so the question is, it sounds like a very good question. Unwritten Torah, telephone, sounds good to me. How can we trust it? We've already given the real answer, and the real answer is, we know the names. We know, so to speak, where they live, all those sages in those 40 generations. But let's put that aside. Pious frauds. Okay. So, for me, the question itself is such a great question, because it so beautifully sets up the answer. Let's think about it. Yes, the game of telephone. A few people, there to have a good time, sitting around, whispering, secretly transmitting, whispering, a word, just a nonsensical word, in a room somewhere, in private, one time. And 5 minutes later, it's a totally different word. In fact, it's in Swahili. Ha ha! Okay, great. I didn't even know Swahili. But that's what game of telephone does. And what's the unwritten Torah? It's millions of people. In multiple, thousands of lines of transmission, with cross-pollination. A thousand lines of transmission of tens, scores, hundreds, thousands. The Talmud talks about There were teachers of the Talmud, of the Mishnah, who had thousands of students. Every Shabbat, every Shabbat, even the unlearned populace would gather in the synagogues in their hundreds and their thousands. All this is documented in Jewish history. Every Shabbat, for the teaching of the unwritten Torah. So we have millions of people studying and transmitting this Torah through thousands of lines of transmission, which they then compare notes about. And within any one class, are thousands of them who are then studying with each other and teaching each other in the most public way possible. Not as a whispered secret, in the most public way possible. And then are reviewing it and committing it to memory. It doesn't share the slightest resemblance to the game of whispers, or of Chinese whispers, or telephone. In fact, that only brings into bold relief exactly what the uniqueness of the unwritten Torah was. And as we mentioned before, it's the very fact of the unwrittenness of the Torah that ensures its accurate transmission. It's because it has to be given, handed down from teacher to student, that the teacher is going to see to it that the student knows exactly what he's teaching him, that he won't misunderstand it, and he won't intentionally distort it. And he's going to see to it that the student is a student of high ethical standing, of solid moral fiber, a student who's earnestly and honestly, intellectually honest and interested in learning God's purpose for humanity. But more important perhaps than all of this is, in talking about the telephone unwritten Torah comparison, is that telephone is a game. The unwritten Torah is anything but a game. We're playing for keeps. This is God's purpose for humanity, for all of creation. It is what will guarantee us eternal life. It is what we were brought down to this world to fulfill and to accomplish. It's the furthest thing from a game one can imagine. You know, the Altar of Nevarik, one of the great Musar sages of the early 20th century, was once discoursing with a master, with an enlightened fellow, an agnostic. And they were jousting, they were going at it, you know, with a thrust and parry back and forth about Jewish faith and the fundamentals of Jewish faith and so on. And this enlightened fellow, you know, as irreligious, as agnostic as he was having a great time of it. It was just an intellectual feast for him. And then at one point he looked at his watch, and they had met in an inn somewhere, and he was there by wagon. The Altar of Nevarik was staying over the night. But this fellow had stopped over there just for dinner, and he had met the Altar of Nevarik, Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz, and they're having this, you know, this back and forth. And he looks at his watch, and he realizes, you know, he's got to move on because he has miles to go before he sleeps, as Frost put it. And he calls out to his wagon driver and says, "Saddle up the horse. We're gonna have to go soon." The moment the Altar of Nevarik heard that, he turned around and walked away. He abruptly ended the conversation, and the fellow said, "Rabbi, where are you going? I was having such a great time. Well, let's continue. I have another 15 minutes. He said, "You have another 15 minutes? Oh, that's wonderful. This is not a game for me. This is life. This is about truth. If you have 15 minutes, that means that I have 15 minutes to prove the truth to you. And if we're in the middle of it, and you're not sure, and I just asked you a fantastic question, or made an amazing, incisive point you never thought of, which shakes the foundations of your unbelief, well, but the horse beckons. You got to leave. You're not interested in truth. You're interested in intellectual game playing. I'm not. Bye." That's what it's about. It's about truth. It's not about games. So, and I guess we'll end sort of with this. So, let's think about, we were God. And we had a message of the greatest earth-shaking, eternal importance to transmit down the generations through a very, very turbulent history to the Jewish people, and for them to carry it on to the world at large. And we were looking for the most rock-solid messengers upon whom to rely to accurately and ethically transmit this message. What are the characteristics we would look for in such messengers? Well, here's a short list. Number one, we'd look for sterling character. Character of superlative ethical levels, but combined with brilliance. Combined with tremendous intellectual prowess. If you're good, but some are dull, no, you're good, wonderful, but some are dull. If you're sharp as a razor, but your tongue is equally sharp, and your heart is equally untrue or uncaring, no, big trouble as well. It's got to be the combination. And the messengers of the unwritten law, the ones that were not voted in, but the ones that were recognized by acclamation by the Jewish people in every generation down to this very one, have had that combination. It's the Reb Chaim Leizer Grudzinski, the undisputed leader of world Orthodox Jewry in the first half of the 20th century, who was someone of such unspeakable intellectual brilliance that when a ledger of dozens of pages of charity disbursements and receipts containing thousands and thousands of digits and names and numbers and addresses was lost, he recreated it from memory. They know because they found it a day later. And he wasn't off by one. But he's the same man that when he went for the first time to his summer dacha, to his summer bungalow out in the forests in the outskirts of Vilna, and he approached the bungalow, all of a sudden he started backtracking. And his assistant says to him, Rebbe, where's the rope going? He said, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to wait about a half hour, or however long it is. I'm going to take a seat over there on the bench. What's the problem? He wouldn't say. So the student went closer, and he heard that the non-Jewish maid, who had been cleaning up for him, preparing the bungalow for his arrival, was singing to herself. Jewish law didn't permit him to listen to her singing. So this rabbi, the acknowledged leader of world Jewry, to whom millions paid homage, didn't walk in and say, I'm sorry, miss, but you're not really... No. I'll cool my heels while she finishes singing to herself. Let her enjoy. Intellectual brilliance, ethical brilliance. The combination. It's essential. Indispensable. Of course, what's equally indispensable to be a trusted messenger of this message is brutal honesty. Brutal honesty, a relentless pursuit of truth, regardless of the stakes. The Yamshel Shlomo commentary, Talmudic commentary, derives from a number of sources in the Talmud that when we think that there are three cardinal sins for which, to prevent the transgression of which, a Jew must forfeit his life, give up his very life, adultery, illicit relationships, and idolatry, and murder, says Yamshel Shlomo, no. The Talmud demonstrates in numerous places that there's a fourth. Distortion of Torah. You distort Torah? If you're a Jew, a believing Jew, must forfeit his life rather than distort Torah. That's how important it is to us. It's a matter of life and death for us. And again, you have stories throughout the Talmud about this, beginning with Moshe Rabbeinu himself. When in the written Torah, Moses, is shown to have made a mistake, as his brother Aaron demonstrates that he's made a very basic mistake in Jewish law, Moses did not suffice with admitting it in private to Aaron. Rather, the Midrash tells us that he sent out messengers to proclaim it, to publicize it throughout the entire camp of the Israelites, millions strong. Moses says, I made a mistake. My brother Aaron was right. Here's what the law really says. When Shimon Hamsoni, in Baba Kama 41b, when Shimon Hamsoni had been embarked on a life or years long intellectual project, Torah project, of interpreting the meaning of S, one of the most commonly occurring words in the entire Torah, hardly has its own meaning. S, a two-letter word. There are hundreds of appearances of the word S in the Torah. And he'd explained every single one of them. Perhaps not every single one, but he had explained hundreds of them. Until he came to one that baffled him. One that says, S, Hashem, lokech hatira. S, your God Hashem, you shall fear. And he didn't know what the S could possibly be conveying in that word. What did he do? Did he fudge it? Did he say, I'll sleep on it, I'll come back tomorrow, how much can I pay to get rid of this problem? No. He walked away. And he said, I am hereby renouncing my entire project. If I can't explain this one, then intellectual honesty demands that undermines my entire theory, the one that I've used to explain hundreds of instances of this. He walked away from the whole thing. His student said to the rabbi, Years of intellectual toil over here. How could you walk away? He said, the same way I received a reward for the study of this for years, so too I receive reward for walking away from all of it. Until Rabbi Kiva came along and explained that one too. single-minded dedication, selfless sacrifice, the transmitters of the unwritten Torah in every generation, are people who spent their entire lives doing so at the greatest cost in terms of money, in terms of prestige, in terms of everything. There were millionaires, Rabbi Elizabeth Harsom, or Rav Tarfon, or Elizabeth Azaria, who gave away, who had nothing to do with their entire fortunes. Just single-minded study of Torah. Even in this generation, the fellow I studied with at night was telling me, he works for a corporation in Manhattan whose owner is an Orthodox Jew. He's a billionaire. He has classes every day in the corporate offices. Spends hours every day studying Torah. There were sages who fasted 100 fasts to be able to understand Torah. Rav, one of the great sages of the Talmud, one of the great Amoraim, spent 18 months out in the wilds with cattle hands just to be able to understand the difference between a permanent blemish and a temporary blemish in a firstborn animal. Just to be able to understand a piece of Torah. He moved his entire study hall out to the Wild West for 18 months. The people that were the wife of Rabbi Akiva, who said goodbye to her husband for 24 years because what he was doing with his life was that important to her. The unbelievable dedication. Down to this very day, we have thousands of Kollel fellows around the world who are supremely talented. People, guys who could be top corporate attorneys and engineers and physicians and so on. And we know that because some of them, after many years of study, go out and actually achieve those positions. But many of them stay for decades studying Torah because they want to be true messengers of this message. The stamina and the willpower that it takes. I mean, Dr. Akiva Katz talks in one place about how he had been a physician, and then he was an officer in the South African Army, and he came to our Samantha to study Talmud for the first time, and he talks about what it was like those first weeks and months. He said he was exhausted beyond recognition, more exhausted than he had ever been in all his years of training in medicine, in all his years of being in the South African bush in the Army. It's physically, literally physically, not just mentally exhausting. And then a fierce determination to transmit the teachings forward. Finally, we have all sorts of mechanisms to ensure accuracy. A student has to use the exact language that his teacher used, not to diverge from it. In dozens, scores of places in the Talmud, the Talmud spends precious real estate determining who said what. This rabbi said the name of that rabbi. Sometimes you'll have a five-name chain of attribution. No, the other one says, no. There's one difference. There's one name different. The kind of efforts that the rabbis exerted in order to ensure accurate transmission. And finally, the single greatest, any Torah scholar will tell you, the single greatest ingredient in being a messenger, in achieving greatness in Torah, is review. I'm talking about just a couple of times, and then we're off to the next thing. We're talking about Rav Moshe Feinstein having gone through the entire Talmud at least 202 times. We don't know how many more times before he left the world, because we only know that it's at some point he called someone up and made a l'chaim because he had just finished his 202nd time. But that was the Talmud. What really knocked my socks off is when I heard that he had gone through the entire Prima Gadim, which is a super gloss commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, which is in letters that are yay big, and it's literally written in the shortest of shorthand, almost indecipherable, impossible to understand without breaking into a sweat on every paragraph. And he had gone through the entirety of that commentary on the entire Shulchan Aruch about some 60-odd times to give up the Talmud. I was going to conclude with something with a reference to, but I'll just conclude with this. And I mean it. And that is to say that I talked about the fact that 5 years ago there was a completion of the Talmud, a celebration of that, with 90,000 strong at Bet Life. And after that celebration, that was actually 13 years ago this month. It was in May of 2005. And a couple of months after that, another important event, shall we say, took place, this one in Berlin, in the heart of Berlin, where the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe was unveiled for the first time. I don't know how many people have been there. I haven't. I've seen pictures of it, picture right here. It's really an amazing sight to behold. Let me just share with you something that happened. The architect of this thing was a fellow named Peter Eisenman. I think he might be Jewish. certainly not in the least bit observant. Not sure if he's German or American. But in any event, there's a Rabbi Josh Spinner, who's the head of the yeshiva in Berlin. And he says as follows: I attended the opening of the Berlin Memorial yesterday, and I asked the architect, Peter Eisenman, whether indeed the number 2,711 was incidental. Because what this memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe consists of in the heart of Berlin is 2,711 stelae. Huge cinder blocks. Of each one is a different height and width and length, and just the most... there's no rhyme or reason to any of it. Nor is there any writing on any of these blocks whatsoever. You just wander between these thousands of blocks and think thoughts and contemplate what happened to the Jews, etc. It's this modernistic idea. And when Rabbi Spinner had learned that there were exactly 2,711, he asked the architect at this meeting, said, did he know that it was it incidental? He responded that not only was it incidental, but accidental. The number of columns intended at the site was much higher, but was reduced due to various considerations. He was shocked and amazed when I told him that the number of pages in the Talmud is none other than precisely 2,711. He asked for verification. I rushed to the business center of a nearby hotel and printed out several articles about the recent Siyum HaShas at MetLife and gave them to Eisenman. Some 5 kilometers away from the Berlin Memorial, in a corner of the Beis Midrash of our yeshiva, late in the evening after the nighttime study session and the evening services, a small group joined the new cycle of the Daf Yomi, of the Page a Day Talmud study, a few weeks ago. This is the first Daf Yomi group in Berlin in, well, we all know in at least how many years. I'll just say this, in concluding. The rabbis teach, Ein oisim nefashos letzadikim, Divrayim hein hein zichreinam. Jerusalem Talmud teaches, we don't construct, we Jews, we're not into memorials. You'd never know it from some of the demonstrations of the Jewish edifice complex in synagogues across the country. But the bottom line is, we're not into memorials. Not physical ones, at least. Because we say their words are the memorial. Well, the words of the unwritten Torah are not in a Torah scroll, black and white. The rabbis say they're carved, kosvei maluach libecha. It's carved in the hearts and souls of every one of us, every Jew. It's a living, dynamic organism, the beating heart of the Jewish people. And that can only be because it's an unwritten Torah. So yes, it's an amazing thing, and perhaps if I'm one day in Berlin, I'll go visit the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe. But there's no question that if this evening I walk into a Jewish study hall, and I see a Jew sitting in the corner studying a page of the Talmud, I'll know that is a more fitting and a louder memorial, a more fitting memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe, and a more fitting memorial to our entire history and the essence of what it means to be a Jew than anything that exists in Berlin. Thank you.
I'm here to